Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
This is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Kai talking about the underreported news with regard to race, justice, and equity, the news that you probably should have heard about but didn't, and you will now. Here we go. This week, the Supreme Court heard opening arguments over the right to access abortion pills. Now, this Supreme Court don't have faith in them, y'all. Like, what is going on with this court, especially the way that the majority was installed on this court? Support nationwide abortion freedom and show them where they can stick their gavels while you're at it. Pick up any item from Crooked's No Trespassing collection, and a portion of the proceeds will go to Vote Save America's Fight Back Fund, which currently supports abortion rights organizations across Arizona, Nevada, and Florida. Head to crooked.com/store to shop now.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. We're so happy to be back with you this week. I am Kaya Henderson, and you can find me on Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
I'm Miles E. Johnson. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok at Feral Rapture.
And this is DeRay at DIY on Twitter.
So, friends, lots of interesting things happening this week. Can we start with Candace Owens and the Breakfast Club interview that Miles sent to us this week? And I will confess that I knew Candace Owens was. I know what her shtick is and all of that jazz. But I listened to that whole entire interview, and that was my first time really, you know, delving into the Candace Owens universe. Oh, my soul, friends. I mean, I don't even know where to start. What I will say is, I don't think that Candace believes a third of what she talks about. I think that she, like a lot of people, have staked out this place where she was controversial. She makes a lot of money, whatever, whatever. And I thought the most ironic thing about that whole interview was, you know, they were talking about her friction with Ben Shapiro because of her pro-Palestinian stance. And, you know, Charlamagne was like, well, you know, shouldn't he have fired you by now? And she said, Ben Shapiro doesn't have the power to fire me. And then the next day, she was fired.
Okay.
So I thought that was very interesting, but
feeling black now.
My favorite meme was like, when you complain about DEI and then they fire you.
Uh-huh.
I'm always super fascinated with, okay, maybe I need to stop. I'm overusing some words. I'm not super, nor am I necessarily fascinated. That is just part of my my lexicon.
Like, let me rate it in. Let me rate it in.
I am a tidbit curiously peaked with Candace Owens. I think the thing that is the most interesting is for me is when you don't. That's why I'm glad that you all watched it, is because I think she's really interesting with how normal she sets things up. Like, I think that if you're somebody who's coming from an ignorant place, I'm not using it as a pejorative, just you don't know about a thing or anything like that, how she sets it up was logical, and she'll kind of connect it with logic, and you're like, oh, I kind of believe that. Me too. Why is everybody talking about chicken in their private parts in the songs? And then she'll connect it with, and this is how come insert conservative far right thing should happen. I'm like, huh, that's She's an interesting monster to watch. Yeah.
She's dangerous because she's very smart. She is very smart. She sounds quite reasonable. Mm-hmm. She gives you her pedigree and you're like, okay, like she's been to good schools and whatever. She's also giving you a little, I'm black. I was discriminated against in high school. I blah, 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 whatever, whatever. And so it sounds very, very reasonable. But you're right, Miles. If you don't do your own research, if you don't know a lot of what she's talking about for your own self, you will go down a road that is not the right road, child. But I think perhaps the most hilarious moment of that interview was, you got to revoke the black card, child, because the people said, God is good. And she said, amen.
It was the best. She said, God is good. Amen. You're like, what? Amen.
For those people who have never been to a black church in your life, it is our custom that when somebody says God is good, we say in response, all the time. And then the person says all the time, and we say God is good. It is like saying God bless you after you sneeze, right? It is just that regular. And she says, oh, I've never heard that before. And they said, have you ever been to a black church? And she's like, I guess not enough, which was kind of interesting. Mm.
I've been surprised to see people that I know just intrigued by her in a way. And I'm like, you know, she to me is entertainment, but I think you're right that like she presents it well. There's like, you know, the best liars always have a kernel of truth, and she has like a kernel of something mm-hmm. true in what she says. Mm-hmm. I think what this reminds me of, though, is something we talked about, is that this is the, like, wash, rinse, repeat cycle of what happens, is that they were going to throw that girl away. There's like, we knew that on day one, that she was a disposable, that she will become famous off of criticizing black people and being the black woman who doesn't like black people, that, like, she will become famous in white supremacist circles for that, and then they will throw her away when they don't need her, and they'll replace her with somebody else. That is just, we saw that coming 10,000 miles away.
And she showed up on grandma's doorstep with, you know, now she's coming back to the black community. Now she's on Charlamagne and Joe Budden. Did you see that?
There's another show where she's like, black artists are so, black people are so creative, and black art is so powerful.
Yeah, she said that in the interview.
Yes.
She did that somewhere else too.
She's back. Probably her running bit.
She's back, and Candace wants to come back to the cookout, y'all.
And I think also I'm super tinfoil hat when it comes to black conservatism. Like I'm kind of all in sold. So I do think there's something about her getting thrown away like she did. I'm a little concerned about like what she'll end up finding next. And when I think about how like the far right is fractioning off, I don't know. I could see little like alliances of just like transphobic but not totally accepted black conservatives that make their own section. And I'm always, I don't know, sometimes it feels a little easier or safer when you're just that token in the white space because you're a weirdo. But if you get too many black people who are believing the same BS at one time, and then all of a sudden there's 10 and it's a group and it's a movement, then it's, oh, y'all came together and made, maybe I should stop talking, but I'm like, I don't want Black Fox. You know what I mean? I don't want them creating a black answer to that, because then that creates a culture around it. Whereas when you're just with Ben Shapiro, you're just a token.
Mm-hmm. I will say, you know, the thing that I found effective with these kind of people is actually like what, I know it's simple, but the question of like, God is good. It's like the simple questions where they have to like, what is racism? Like those sort of questions are where it short circuits, right?
Yeah.
Because you got to define the terms with these people. When you just go in as if there's a shared understanding, she will flip the script every time and just run circles around you. Mm-hmm. And that's what she does. And you notice that she never debates political. Like, she's not on political podcasts. She's on culture podcasts talking about mm-hmm. politics. And mm-hmm. that is for a reason. Mm-hmm. That she's not on a show where, like, you can pull up her old clips. Or they just aren't doing that. And, like, as much as I'm I'm annoyed with all the people who've interviewed her. I also mindful that their expertise is the culture. Like, that's what they know well. They know music and art and fashion and sports. They don't know what's going on in the White House. They never, like, you know, they're reading an article 10 minutes before they interview her.
Uh-oh.
I don't, they are not experts on it. They aren't.
Charlamagne was at the White House. He interviewed presidents, candidates.
So is Sexy Red.
I love it.
What did Sexy Red say? What, the day gotta end? What was the
quote? That's Glorilla. Hold on. Oh. Your black card is up for review. No, you got 14 days. That was Glorilla. That was Glorilla.
No, let me look.
Oh my Jesus. God. You ain't gotta tell me how many times I done watched that. Was Glover. Yes.
You know, all of them.
No.
All the rappers been to the White House, and that did not make them experts on politics.
I guess the only thing I was trying to push back on, just very softly push back on, was the fact that Charlamagne individually has really pushed himself to talk about politics and be taken seriously there. So, of course, not just like being invited to the White House, but he's put himself in countless times in these very political conversations as a voice, and that it's even been documented. I think that was it was an article, I think, in the Washington Post, really dissecting Charlamagne as a go-to voice for a lot of politicians, both Republican and Democrats. So I think just dropping the responsibility. So having somebody like Candace Owens there and having really no pushback, no interruption to that. I think that, sure, yeah, maybe Glorilla doesn't have that responsibility, but I think Charlamagne does. Because Glorilla did say, "That ain't my business."
She said that. She did. Glorilla. She's in the reference. You're Glorilla. Yeah, I'm not. So we aren't saying different things.
Yeah.
I agree that the responsibility is there. I'm just saying that the expertise is not. So they have been in the room. I think that they are. I think that there's a group of people who are bridging the gap between politics and culture for people. But, you know, Candace is no fool. Like, Candace knows her. She knows enough to twist it. And yes. I think they know more than their listeners know, which is not more than or as much as Candace knows. Candace, that's what I'm trying to say.
That is right.
Did y'all see, though, today? I know this is, you know, I'm just bringing this up because I saw today is that the CEO of Boeing's going to step down. Like, the leadership, some of the top leaders at Boeing. Shout out to them, because I've been nervous to fly. So I'm happy that whoever forced these people out, that ain't got nothing to do with, you know, it actually has something to do with race, because remember that they tried to say that the plane problems were because of DEI. Do you remember that?
Yes, that was wild. One of the things.
And it's all white people resigning. It wasn't us.
Has there been a settlement about that, about what
get the door coming off?
Yeah,
I think they got $1,000. No, I think they got $1,000. Yeah, I think they got, I'm pretty sure it was like $1,000.
For the people on the plane?
It was $1,000 per person.
Just stop it. Just stop. That's ridiculous. You're going to pay me way more than $1,000 if the door flies off my plane. Oh, I'm my just God. Letting American and Delta and whoever else I fly know. It's going to cost y'all more than $1,000.
And even when y'all pay me, I'm still calling Gail King.
What about Princess Kate's revelation? We talked about it a little bit last week. And I feel like I called it. I was like, what if she's really sick and she doesn't want to tell her kids and yada, yada, yada. Meanwhile, the world bullied the lady into saying whatever she said, that she got the cancer.
She was not a bully. Okay. I'm sad DR is not here, because me and DR are on the same page about this one.
Our family will not be divided over the royal family.
Okay, I hear that. I'm down
our
with
royal
that.
Family is more important.
So. I don't care that much. But I will say that just because they sent out the janky picture does not give you a right to know all of her business. That's my position.
I just think they gave up. This is like the cost of imperialism. And they gave up a private life for the riches of imperialism. And here we are. And I think that, honestly, it's like it's the weird lie. It's like the fake photo. So the fake photo is weird. Then, you know, if she has cancer, blaming the fake photo on her is weird. Y'all could have been like some random social media person.
to me, this is a whole generational thing, right? Like, there's a huge generational divide that I think is what we see playing out. Because what the palace wants to do is what it's been doing, status quo stuff, smoke and mirrors, put out a picture, do whatever, whatever. These young royals have been very different, right? Probably not a ton more, but they have gone out of their way to try to create a modicum of privacy for themselves and their families, even with Harry and Meghan moving away and da-da-da. Like, they're trying to eke out a new thing. And I think what you are seeing is the culture clash, right? The company is like, this is what we do. We deflect, we edit photos, we blah, blah, blah. And she's like, bruh, I'm out here getting chemo and trying to raise my kids, and we got to do this a different way. And so, but the crazy thing that I heard this morning on the news was the reporter said, well, now that she's made this video and explained, you know, there's an outpouring of empathy and people are super whatever. And do we think that, you know, the speculation is going to stop? And this reporter on the Today Show said, well, we suspect that a lot of the conspiracy theories and mean things that came out about her were coming from Russia and Iran. And so we don't think that they're going to stop. They're meant to weaken the British political blah, blah, blah. I was like, wait a minute.
No,
wait,
let's hear some black folks call Russian Duran.
What?
Because I know the Negroes who did that, and they are not from Russia or
right.
Not Iran.
Russia they and are just Iran? Nosy. That's what we doing?
I think the cracks started showing, you know, of course, during the Meghan and Harry stuff. And I think one of the things about that that Oprah interview that I found the most fascinating, which, by the way, if you can find that Oprah interview with them, please send it to me because it has been washed. I'm like, where is that interview? Why can I not really? Find it? I cannot find it anywhere, paid, free, nothing. And I'm a LimeWire child, so I know how to pirate. So if I can't find it, it's unfindable. But anywho, I thought what was so interesting was how antiquated the palace was. I think sometimes when something's really big and rich, me being also somebody who lives under capitalism, I also associate that with sophisticated and complex and savvy. And I'm shocked with the Meghan stuff, how unsavvy it is. Like, it's that old, like, even what they were doing to Meghan was that old school, old Hollywood reporter, I'll give you a scoop if you don't do this. Like, this old stuff. I'm like, well, do you not know that a tweet can just set this off? Like, I don't know. It's like they're living and operating in an old, 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 old world and trying to apply that to this very new world. And, this is just one of the many cases where I think we're beginning to see, like, the crack of that. Like, I mean, I don't want to give the palace any tips for obvious reasons, but they could use maybe, I don't know if it's a youth thing. I don't know if it's respecting and understanding the computer things and the internet stuff, but they can use some people over there who really get how this new culture is working. And it's not just, you know, giving scoops to the gossip to cover up this and da-da-da-da.
Let me just double back on the Boeing thing real quick. So I don't know where I saw the $1,000 thing, but I can't refund it. So maybe the $1,000 is not quite right. But
what $1,000 is right next to Sexy Red. My name is Business.
right next to Sexy Red. But Boeing is being sued for $1 billion by a set of airline passengers on that flight.
Those are my zeros.
And being investigated by the Justice Department, actually, for violating a 2021 settlement that resulted in two plane crashes. So hopefully there is, you know, there might not be a Boeing soon. It might be renamed the last name of one of the people who was on that
hopefully
plane.
It'll be Jenkins Airlines soon.
Right, Jenkins and Jones.
Okay.
The other person who got to pay a whole lot of money is y'all's former president, Donald Trump. Today is the day. Sister girl, Tish James, about to move on this thing, honey. For people who don't know, well, today's Monday. You'll hear us on Tuesday. But Donald Trump is due to pay a $454 million bond for the judgment in the case that Tish James won about them doing business fraudulently in New York. And in fact, it was due 30 days ago, but she gave him a 30-day extension because we're gracious like that. And as of like Thursday or Friday, he didn't have any money. There were 30 surety companies that wouldn't bond him. And then over the weekend or something, he sold Truth Social. What's the deal, DeRay? He made some kind of a deal where he says he got $500 million liquid, and I don't think so. But if he does not pay today, Tish James is seizing assets, baby. The Trump golf course, Trump Towers, and a few other things. So it's about to go down.
So Truth Social, the social media platform that he and the right wing created as a alternate universe, he is a 58.1% owner of the common stock in the company. And they have wildly, and it makes no money. It's like it literally is like a non-money making thing.
That's called a money losing business.
It's almost like money laundering is what it is. So they are selling it for more than $3 billion. He would get $3 billion in the sale. That's how much they're selling it for. So it's a $5.7 billion deal, so that he can come out a billionaire on paper. Again, this is all like fuzzy money, but it would give him enough money to pay for the settlement. Now, let me tell you, the social media money, the Truth Social lost $10.6 million from its operations in the first 9 months of 2023 on revenue of $3.4 million. And it has been funding itself by borrowing $40 million through convertible promissory notes that can be paid back in stock.
Isn't this what the judgment is about? Him fraudulently overvaluing his businesses in order to take out loans to make money? Like, isn't that the whole crux of the thing? And here we are right back at it again.
I hope she seizes the hotels, Trump Tower, all of it, rename them. Make him housing for the homeless. Like, I hope that Tish comes in and swoops up everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm. They notified the golf club, his Seven Springs estate, and a few other properties that, and she can go after property in other states as well. And so I think by tonight's news or tomorrow morning's news, we'll know what's happening.
Well, how humiliating. What he deserves.
Like, I love that. But,
yeah, because everybody has like kind of the same, you know, I don't know anybody who has never had a bill or who had never had an error of any type of money concerns. And I don't know, $500 million. You know, that's just a lot of money. And then I'll be scared all the time.
He's selling $300 sneakers, right? And the blacks like the sneakers and they're buying them. So
we see it on television. I don't know why when I hear this news, my mind goes to like, oh goodness, like that is just, I know that he's just going, you know, nuts. And because of his kind of like declining mental state and stuff, I just know it just is hell over there. So that's where my mind went. But hopefully it'll force him to do a reality show about it so we can just eat popcorn and watch his misery. Mm. As a family. I will watch it.
Popcorn.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Provincetown Tourism. Who's planning a trip to Provincetown this year? If you've been before, or if it's your first time, you deserve to enjoy life on the wild side. If you take pride in where you travel, then you're ready for P-Town, ready for an adventure. Provincetown is always filled with pride. It welcomes everybody, diversity of all shapes, sizes, kinds. It's the place where cultural diversity has a place. If you like glamour, dining, dancing, entertainment, hiking, biking, beaches, and the overall unique experience, you'll find it all in Provincetown. Provincetown is queer-friendly, quirky, you can be yourself, and, like I said, you have a good time. If you've never been to P-Town, you have to plan a trip, and every time you visit, your experience will never be the same. P-Town has many fun-themed weeks for everybody LGBTQ, like Pride, Girl Splash, Bear Week, Family Week, Carnival, Gerrans Week. So sashay your way to ptowntourism.com, the official guide to Provincetown. ptowntourism.com.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by Factor. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. I am so excited that Factor is a new sponsor of ours. I have been on the website because I'm about to order a bunch of different Factor meals. They have things like roasted garlic filet mignon and shrimp, charred corn and shredded chicken cavatappi. They got Baja salmon and chimichurri ground beef bowl. And literally like 2 minutes, Factor's ready-to-eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. You can customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. You can pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. They are celebrating Earth Day all month long, so look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. Now, you've heard me talk before about meal services, and I'm super excited to try this as a busy, you know, professional woman who does not always have time to cook. The idea of no prep, no cleanup, 2 minutes, and this wide variety of what are gourmet by all accounts. I was reading the ratings on the website and people have nothing but good things to say. So you should head over to factormeals.com/PSTP50 and use the code PSTP50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code PSTP50 at factormeals.com/PSTP50 for 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, what's your social battery looking like right now? You know, it's been a lot going on. I was drained last week. I'm pretty energetic right now as we start this week. But there's, you know, a lot going on, especially as we go into spring. This has been a wild couple of years. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially now that gatherings and group things are picking up as we go into the spring. What's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you drive around people. Maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/people today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/people. I'm going to say one thing that is not my actual news, but I'm fascinated by the measles outbreaks that is happening. So measles has finally hit New York City. It is back because in Long Island, a midwife falsified 1,500 vaccination records for children in recent years. She gave pellets instead of actual vaccines that would have protected them from a host of things like measles, mumps, and rubella. So not necessarily in New York City because it was Nassau County, but she was providing alternative immunizations and families did not know. And I just am floored by the anti-vax folks who have just done some really wild things. And like now all these kids have to get revaccinated or vaccinated for the first time around diphtheria, hep B, rubella, chicken pox, and all that stuff, and they can't go back
and
to school.
And they can't go to school until that stuff is done. Take it from me.
So that means, that means that the people, so what probably happened is like the parents didn't want the kids to be vaccinated, so they found this nurse who was willing to do this, or this person who was willing to do this. Or she did it on her own.
She didn't believe in vaccination.
Oh, so the parents didn't know?
Yeah, so she did it. It became, she started it in the 2019-2020 school year. And yeah, she just made this up and she got fined $300,000 and has already paid $150,000 back.
Which means she made a lot of money off her little fake vaccinations because she's got cash on hand.
Crazy.
What? Wait, hold on. Make sure, because you know, I am neurodiverse, divergent. Child. So let's make sure I'm understanding this all correctly. Walk with me. This woman took other people's babies and didn't give them the vaccine. But these babies weren't vaccinated because this woman didn't believe in the vaccines. Not because these were conservative or anti-vax, whatever, like anti-vax parents. And they were like, well, will you not give my child a vaccine but still do the march? She just did this to make a buck and or because of her own political...
It looks like it's a little bit of both, so that it looks like both she lied and that people did seek her out and paid her to falsify the records.
Got it. Yeah, we are 5 years from bringing leprosy back. So,
and it was across 300 different schools, ages 4 to 18. And what's crazy is that none of the fake records were for COVID. That's what's really crazy. Like the anti-vaxxer
because
COVID
she started her thing before COVID got started, right? She started her fraudulence before the COVID vaccines were available, right? And the way they were controlling the COVID vaccines, you couldn't get it everywhere, right? Like you had to check the list to see who had it and blah, blah, blah. So there was some control around that, but not measles apparently.
Well, and I think a lot of people connect those vaccines, anti-vaxxers connect those vaccines to like autism and stuff like that. So that's like the conspiracy belief behind why they don't do it, right?
And now your kid's going to die from chicken pox because,
Well, calm down, DeRay.
So my real news is, I don't know if you all remember about... the city councilwoman in Brazil, in Rio, who was murdered years ago, and her name was Marielle Franco. She first came on the radar to me because she was investigating police misconduct, and she got very publicly assassinated. A young woman, they just arrested the people that they suspect of being her killers, and they arrested the former chief of police in Rio, a Brazilian congressman, and his brother, who is the state auditor. Now, this all came up because in 2018, the military took over the local city police in Rio. And when they took over the police, the military police replaced the civilian police officers, and 8,500 soldiers were deployed on the streets in the name of dealing with gangs. And that led to a 40% increase in killings by the police. And that was 1,500 people were killed by the police in 2018 alone, the year that the military was in charge of the police. Now, when Bolsonaro, who was like the very right-wing president, when he took over, he appointed this guy to be the head of the civilian police in Rio when the city got it back. And she was challenging all of the work that they had done. And she had just gotten appointed to be the head of the commission to review what happened in the killings of the police when she was assassinated. So that is the wild part of this, that the police killed her. There'd always been rumors about it, but we didn't know. The even wilder part, though, is that it was the police who oversaw the investigation. One of the guys who got who has who's like on house arrest. He wrote the book about her murder, being like, you know, we're going to investigate everything.
That's the grimy. And it was a bestseller. Like, that's the grimy part. He made, he's one of the people who ordered the hit, and he made $1 zillion off the book about it. What kind of hell, fresh hell is this?
Wild. So I bring this here just because I was like, you know, we talk about the police in America, but they killed her because she was looking into abuse of police power. And I'm telling y'all, if only we got to see what happened behind the scenes in all of these places with the police, people would turn this thing upside down.
Whoa. That is just... Okay. I'm not one to say, like, not all cops or anything like that. So, but I do want to make it clear that I'm not making, like, a blanket statement, but... You know, we're a podcast, short on time. But I think it's interesting to investigate the people who are attracted to police work. I do. Like, I think that this is sociopathic, right? It just has to be. And I think that even when you look at, like, domestic violence rates when it comes to police officers and stuff like that, the things that, I don't know, it just seems like the people who are often, I don't want to say often, there's people who are attracted to being police who are not right in the head. And I think that says something about the institution of police. And I also think it says something about what you need to be able to psych test in histories and all these other things you need to be able to pass to even be considered to be a police officer or to be a part of that, because it just seems like a place where the most crooked of minds are attracted to as well, not just this kind of like brave soul propaganda narrative that we kind of always get. Do y'all disagree?
I will say, as somebody whose kid is considering a career in law enforcement, and as somebody who created the police cadet program here in Washington, D.C. for our high schoolers to explore law enforcement careers, one of the reasons why we did was we were like, there's a bunch of data, and I think, DeRay, you know this stuff better than me, that when police come from the community that they serve, you get different results when people are motivated to join the police force for different reasons, because they want to help, because they want it to be different. And I got a kid who I'm really proud of who is committed to thinking about law enforcement in new ways. And so shout out to the people who are who want to change the institution. And you're not wrong, Miles. There are a lot of really sick and crazy people who are attracted to this absolute power. So both and. I thought this story was super wild. One, it just reminds me that, like, you know, lawlessness and assassinations, political assassinations, like, we don't hear about them as much as we used to, but they are still a thing. And, you know, not only was this woman young and smart, her wife is actually a city councilwoman as well. And, like, that's dangerous. Y'all both out here in these streets, you know, poking the bear. And, you know, this stuff, at least this was my first time learning about this story. So thanks for bringing it to the pod. But, like, Bolsonaro, the president dude, and the gunmen are hanging out. They live in the same apartment building. Their kids date. The dude who ordered the killing goes to the widow's house and comforts her and is on TV talking about, you know, we're going to, you know, find out who this is. And everybody seemed to know that it was these people. And it took 5 years for them to figure it all out. But I was thinking a lot about the wife. And for 5 years, you've known that this didn't go down the way it was, you know, it's been told. And you know that these people who are smiling in your face are not your real people. And luckily, thankfully, it worked out for her. And we now know, but there are so many of these cases that are unresolved and families never get the kind of closure that they're looking for, especially in these political things. And so I just, wow, this was this was just it. I don't know. It was shocking. My news this week is also from overseas. This week, my news is coming from Wales. Wales, you say. Where is Wales? Wales is a very small country of about 3 million people that is part of the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is made up of 4 countries. I'm a teacher, so I'm going to have to do you a little geography history. The United Kingdom is made up of 4 countries, England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And Wales is putting it down for the culture, my friends. You can't stop brown people's hustles. Wales now holds the distinction of having the first black head of government, not just in Wales, but in all of Europe. Yep, we got us a black first minister of Wales. His name is Vaughan Gething. He's 50. He is a lawyer who was born in Zambia to a Zambian mother and a Welsh father, and he was recently elected first minister. Cousin Vaughan is not just a politician. He previously served as the Welsh health minister for 5 years, including shepherding them through the COVID crisis. Most recently, he served as the country's economic minister. So Cousin Vaughan is a little smart. And now he's the first minister, and he pledged to make Wales a place where, quote unquote, all citizens can celebrate our differences and take pride in all of those things that draw us together. What a lovely message. Interesting factoid, currently 3 of the 4 UK countries now have non-white leaders. The original imperialist country, 3 of the 4 UK countries have non-white leaders. In Wales, we got Cousin Vaughan Gething. In England, Rishi Sunak is the prime minister, and he's of Indian descent. And in Scotland, Sister Humza Yousaf is the first minister and is of Pakistani descent. And so I brought that because who knew that Wales would be the first European country? I'm going to say in current times, because, you know, we still got some conversations to have about Queen Charlotte, but I'll wait till Bridgerton comes back out and we can revisit that. But I just thought that it was interesting because who knew that Europe now had a black head of state? Shout out to Cousin Vaughan. The global majority is coming, y'all. You can't stop us. Okay. That's all I got.
Okay. Shout out to Vaughan. you're going to need all the love and peace and security because, listen, the beginning and end in my experience, through experience and observation, the beginning and end of being the first or only black anything is in these little podcast shout outs, little news clips, the actual job. You like, oh God, these white folks are crazy. When you actually are, you know, going to be doing it. So, you know, sending you all the strength that you need. And can I also say, this is a little, kind of like a goofy comment, but I always feel like the UK's, like parliament minister, they just have such sexier names for their government than we do. I always listen to these stories and I'm like, prime minister, minister of health. I'm like, yeah, I'm so vapid in certain areas of my life. It's embarrassing. I would actually consider a career in government if the names
if we
were
called
those...
you if we called you Lord Miles.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. Prime Minister of Gay Activity of America. I was like, yes. but I'm so proud of Vaughan, and yeah, and I'm also just interested to like documenting and seeing how Vaughan's, you know, political, like the things that he does politically too. Because I think sometimes we can get a little too wrapped into representation. So I love what he's already done. So I'm just interested in seeing that and you know, hopefully being in, you know, he's able to maintain the political grounding that he's established too. And it's going to be interesting to see how he shifts as he serves his time. What is it? What do you say? Serves his time, does his bid. That's jail, huh? As he completes his term in office. Okay.
Yeah. You know, shout out to this guy. I don't know him. I feel like Kiki being like,
you don't know him, but you know most other European heads of state. Why would you know him?
Well, Rishi Sunak, I do know him because he is a right wing politician who has proposed automatically lengthening people who are incarcerated, lengthening their time in prison by just an automatic year. Like, he has proposed lowering net migration in the UK, sending people to Rwanda to get processed. Like, he has been, so I say all this to say that these people are being the first when we finally are having a real honest public conversation about the limits of identity politics and representation. Mm-hmm. So let's see what old Wales guy got to say and do. You know, he's getting my benefit of the doubt on the front end, but they just put a brown face on white politics in the UK. That's what, mm-hmm. That's what they did in England. So mm-hmm. I'm not in the choir yet as a fan of Mr. Wales, but I am interested in what he got going on.
That's fair. That is fair. Trust and verify.
He has not earned his place on your grandma's.
I don't even know if trust. It's like, I like you enough right now. I'm intrigued, but I gotta see.
I'm down with that.
I always think about my grandma's wall.
He's with Kennedy and Martin Luther King and stuff Jesus.
Like, yes, uh-huh. And now Barack owned it. Uh-huh. So I'm like, he has not earned his place on that wall yet.
Oh no, no. But so I think he's a Labor Party dude. All right. Well, we will keep our eye on Cousin Vaughn. But in the meantime, I try to operate with a sense of possibility about my cousins until they give me a reason not to. So, Cousin Vaughn, I'm sending you good vibes. Hold it down. Don't embarrass us. Don't make us have to kick you out the cookout.
Cousin Vaughn, don't prove us wrong.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can live out your MasterChef dream when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
News comes from someplace just as exotic and beautiful and royal in my heart, which is Atlanta, Georgia. The Georgia is the place that helped raise me, and that documentary on Freaknik, it just. So I'm about to give you a double a classic Miles Yin and Yang. We'll start with the light part. I forgot which light part is Yin or Yang. But we'll start with the light part. Light part is it made me so proud to be from Atlanta to watch that Freaknik documentary because, you know, being from, well, I'm from Georgia and I grew up a little bit in Atlanta, so don't get me started. So I was Marietta and then Atlanta when I got into my teens. But anywho, because you will get beat up. So say you're from Atlanta, you were raised in Atlanta. But I was so proud of being from Georgia when I was watching that documentary, because that history of Freaknik just reminded me of how many things the South, and specifically Atlanta, has given culture that are so significant. Seeing Outkast in that documentary, seeing CeeLo, Goody Mob, in that documentary, really just, I don't know, there's just a special feeling that only Atlanta has that feels both like the barbecue, but like the barbecue on Mars. Like, it's like, what is this like alternative, like universe we were existing in? I remember, years ago, over 10 years ago, me and my friend, we were roommates, and we were, you know, smoking weed. And we were like, Atlanta feels like Atlantis. This is pre Black Panther. I was like, Atlanta feels like Atlantis, like a Black Atlantis or something. Like, what, like, we would just walk out and just only see Black people. And I love that the documentary really documented that, because that is something so special in Atlanta that even now, living in Brooklyn, I'm not gonna go as far as say I miss it, if I'm being honest, but I do appreciate it about you going someplace and the person who owns the store is Black, the person who's shopping the store is Black, the police officer is Black, the person who does your nails is Black, the person who robbed you is Black, but also the person you gotta tell on to get your money back is Black too. So it just creates this, in your mind, it just creates this like diversity of what Black is, and kind of makes you live in that multiplicity, because there's no, there's just like this insular Black, culture there. So I loved it for that. And it made me feel good. And I love hearing the history of Freaknik, and that it started in the 80s, that it was branching to from the La Freak from Chic. Did not know that. That Chic's La Freak is what made them want to call it Freaknik, because they wanted to bring the freak back. So here's another way. You know, I'm always queering something. Here's another way, inadvertently. there was queer contribution, because, you know, freak, disco, queer people. Yeah, I'm taking the long way home with that. But the dark side is, once they got to these sexual abuse allegations and got to the part about what Freaknik ended up going into, I was shocked. I was like, how much time is left on this documentary? And I looked, and I'm like, 17 minutes left, and you just now talking about this? You needed a whole hour, or you need to cut this thing in half, because that is a huge part of Freaknik. And no offense to Mark Lamont Hill, such a soulful, intellectual, beautiful man on the inside and out. I love Mark Lamont Hill. But the minimizing of what happened at Freaknik, the abuse allegations, and then also there being no feminist investigation as to why this party turned into what it turned into. And I think there was such an opportunity to connect patriarchal power. I think there was just such an opportunity to connect patriarchal power. What happens when sexuality amongst young people with no feminist lens happens. And they just didn't do that work. It really just skated by those scenarios. And I was just kind of amazed that I think that that documentary really wanted more to just kind of like keep Freaknik as this place in people's minds that is warm and free and sexually liberated. And it didn't, and it turned ugly. And we can't just say that it turned ugly if you're doing a documentary, because a documentary is to investigate. So let's investigate why it turned ugly. And if you don't have the tools to explore why it turned ugly, then invite feminist voices on. Again, please do not conflate feminist voices with women voices, because mm-hmm. that is sexist and misogynistic too. So having women there who are not doing necessarily that feminist thinking on what happened is not the representation, you know? Goodness, I feel like I say this woman's name every other week on the podcast, but that bell hooks voice is so necessary to really talk about. This is something that I would have to write, you know, I would have to really get down and busy and really research and really like tease out my thoughts around it. So I don't want to do a disservice about it on this podcast. But there is a feminist analyzation of what went on. And I'm got really annoyed that that just didn't happen. And we're getting so many of these kind of pop-up, I don't know what to call them, like pop documentaries, like documentaries that are that are for public consumption and mainly for public consumption, and them not doing that kind of like necessary work of investigating, like and inviting complex voices to have complex conversations, and just to zoom out, I think that that was also telling about, to me, how the Black community often deals with misogyny and patriarchal abuse and domination, is that, oh, that was an unfortunate thing, and, you know, most people weren't doing it, and da-da-da-da. Cool, most people weren't doing that. What was the thing in the air that made people feel like this was okay to do? Like, you know, most people are not going to rob people. Most people are not going to kill people. But we still need to investigate what is in the air in these spaces or in these communities that is making those things happen. We have to investigate those things. And Barton Lamont Hill talks about that. I don't mean to just zone in on that with, when it comes to him, because it was everybody who was participating. But we always zone in on, oh, it's the poverty that makes people rob people. It's this, it's that. We have those kind of reasons we do those type of investigations. Why did we not do that with Freaknik? Why do we just make it seem like, oh, these out of control bad men came out of nowhere and they just didn't go? And I felt like the only scapegoat was like, oh, they weren't in college and they came. That's, there was no, you know, there's this kind of like weird deification of Uncle Luke for bringing the freak in. There was no investigation of song lyrics. All I heard was Rashida say, you know, this makes you feel good. That's fine for Rashida to say. I want to hear what other feminists, what some feminist voices have to say about those lyrics too, and about what that meant and what that might have influenced people to do or think was okay. I want to understand better about what was consent, what was happening, and so many other dimensions of Freaknik. So yeah, that's just my little feminist rant on the Freaknik doc. Is that I'm really tired of things kind of presenting it themselves as intellectual digs and like intellectual investigations of Black culture. You know, this makes me even more scared about the Twitter documentary, the Black Twitter documentary coming up, because if you're not really doing the complex thinking and questioning, then you're just making something extremely vapid and shallow and not doing the work of a documentary, which to me, a documentary is a type of like visual film textbook. You know, most that used to be something you could rely on in order to get some information and for in order to like really have a record of how people think in our in investigating these things. And that just did not happen. And I want us to do a lot better when it comes to that. And the last thing that I'll say is that I hope that more feminist voices talk about Freaknik, because I do think that what's interesting about this generation is that there's so many feminist voices who have YouTube channels and who still like to write, unlike me, but who still do all those things. So I hope that there's some pushback on how the Freaknik documentary what it talked about. So that's not just the singular piece of content around Freaknik is that. I hope that there's a lot of pushback, so those pushbacks could be part of that dialogue too. And I just hope that we do better when we look back on our histories and we're able to look at the dark just as much as we are able to look at the light. Like I just did. See? Full circle. A yin and yang circle.
I'm trying to figure out how to enter into this conversation, because there was so much happening in that documentary. And, you know, full disclosure, I am of the Freaknik generation. I was in college from wait, hold it. I'm confessing all the things today. I was in college from 1988 to 1992, prime freaknik years. But full disclosure, I was broke in college. Who had to, what? Atlanta? How's I gonna get there? Who was gonna pay? What hotel was you gonna stay at? I'm not staying on nobody's floor in the back of the rim shop. In addition to freaknik, there was also the Virginia Beach experience, Labor Day, which was probably a knockoff of freaknik. But for those of us who couldn't make it all the way south, Virginia Beach for Labor Day weekend was probably the exact same thing as freaknik. And so I have walked the boardwalk of Virginia Beach and seen everything that my 19 and 20 year old eyes were not ready to see. I have watched us be joyful. I have watched us be assaulting and assaulted. And I mean, it was a time, I think, Miles, your takedown was absolutely right. It was literally like three quarters of the way in that they were like, oh, and there were some bad things. And the number of women, I mean, they literally sort of asserted that there were like a couple of rapes and a couple of assaults. There were women and men who were, sexual assault was rampant at Freaknik and Virginia Beach and places like that. And if we're going to tell the truth, we just have to tell the whole truth. That is what it was. And I think you are right. Just having women as executive producers and whatnot, does not guarantee you a critical analysis. I mean, these people have a narrative. There is like, I'm conscious of like who tells your story. And this, I think, was an attempt to reclaim a popular narrative about what Freaknik was by going back to what Freaknik started out. Like, I didn't know it was a group of kids from DC who started it when they, you know, couldn't afford to go home for spring break. And but from at least this telling of the story, it was all clean and wholesome and just college kids coming together for a picnic, which I'm sure there's probably some truth to, but I'm sure there was also a lot more. And I think what has happened over time is, you know, the rap on Freaknik became pretty terrible. And so I think this was some attempt to reclaim the narrative and redirect the narrative. They talked a lot about the economic power of Black people in this documentary and you know, how much money these kids had and how they were spending. It was a marketer's dream. They talked about the impact of Freaknik on hip hop and how hip hop moved. Hip hop basically, you know, took up residence in Atlanta, and that became the hub of Southern hip hop, moved up from Miami. And, you know, literally the South has something to say, and Freaknik enabled that to happen. You know, it talked about how the white business people couldn't do their business. And that's when it started to go down. And the Uncle Luke stuff was really problematic. Also problematic because he's an executive producer. But basically, he sort of took credit for bringing the debauchery to Freaknik. And, you know, problematic is an understatement when it comes to Luke. But I thought that they were trying to do something that was complex and analytical and somewhat critical. And I feel like they failed by, you know, as you noted, Miles, really minimizing. I mean, they literally were like, Black women are flexing their sexuality at Freaknik. Okay, that is some of what happened. But there was a whole lot of other stuff that happened that I think they glossed over. And I think that is a problem. But I will just say, for all of the 50-somethings in the world who were at Freaknik, who were petrified that their children and their children's children and their children's teachers were going to see them on the Freaknik documentary, I think they did a lovely job of blurring people's faces and not holding people accountable for the crazy things that they did when they were in college.
Yeah, I'll just say, you know, there seems to be this really interesting moment where documentaries and documentary shorts are becoming just more commercially profitable and popular. So I remember a time when documentaries were things you had to like search out, and it was like they were tucked away on the platforms that you never, you know, like that was, and all of a sudden we're in this moment where it's like Wendy Williams, there's Black Twitter, there's Freaknik, there's the Nickelodeon, you know, like there are documentaries that are not, they are not hidden. They are not, we're not trying to find them. They are like, they are the conversation right now. And the question becomes, do you have the range to tell the story? And do you have the range to interrogate the story, which are two different questions and not the same? And I'll tell you what I found, especially, you know, obviously I spend most of my time in the criminal justice space, is what I find is two things that trouble me. One is that our best storytellers often don't know the content. They know putting images together. They know the arc of a story. They know how to craft the narrative. They know how to score it on the back end with the music. They know how to edit it and sequence it. The facts, the critical interpretation of the content, rarely do they know super well. So they are either leaning on somebody or just sort of whatever. And like that, I've seen that a million times, or like, I'm like, this person could tell a story, holes everywhere, but like they knew a narrative arc and that works. And I think we have to figure out how to bridge that gap to bring it much closer so that it's not as big of a... The second thing that I find, and this has always bothered me, and maybe we agree or disagree, but especially with things about race and certainly crime and justice, people don't... I found that a lot of people don't take those fields as fields of expertise. So they use their experience as expertise. They're like, well, I know Black people. And you're like, well, I don't really know if that's enough for this thing. Or they're like, well, I was on Black Twitter. And you're like, I don't really know if that was, I don't really know if that's expertise. Just like both of my parents were addicted to drugs, that does not make me an expert on addiction. That makes me an expert on being the child of people, of these two people who were addicted to drugs. And like, I just don't, I found that, especially, you know, I deal with this a lot in the criminal justice space. People literally are like, well, I know somebody in my family is in prison. And I'm like, well, I mean, I get that. And that in no way makes you an expert. Like, this is actually a field of study. You would never make a documentary about physics and assume that you knew as much as a physicist. Like, that wouldn't even be the assumption that you bring into the room. And I feel that way about education. You know, people make docs on schools and you're like, you have never even sat in a classroom for a whole day. Like, you have popped in to film. You don't even know what a day and forget a week or a month, but a day. You don't know what an exhausted teacher looks like after teaching for 8 hours standing up. That is great. You know, like,
you better preach.
So that is what I'm interested in, because I think that this will continue to be an issue. And I don't think we're honest about it because we love the storytellers, that they are the people. They are people we know who have done really cool things in the fiction space. And there's sort of an arrogance that comes when they move into the doc space, which is like, I know it.
I totally 100% agree with you on that, DeRay. And I love when you get, well, preacher DeRay on us. I felt that little wave a couple of times. I'm like, yes, hallelujah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think that when it comes to, what my hope is I do think I'm somebody who's who is a expert in, when it comes to pop culture and Black culture and music and stuff. And I also think that sometimes people who are both experts in those type of fields aren't the people who you like. And I really sometimes wonder if that is what's creating things that are having some things that are out of their depth, meaning that the value of Bell Hooks being in a documentary, being in Tongues Untied, wasn't just because Marlon Riggs was her friend or because he liked Bell Hooks. Bell Hooks has a critical voice if you're going to talk about Black people and women. She has a critical voice. So I do think some of it is just like having to get outside of the network of people who you might like and bring people who make the best story. Because I have seen people, I'm not just talking, to, I mean, I'm extremely privileged because you're hearing my voice right now, but I have seen some people who I think have complex thoughts and ideas, and maybe you don't like them and they are maybe getting excluded from some essential storytelling, and it's making worse art for it, and I would like for us to investigate that too and sit with that. Thank y'all.
The only thing I would say is that this is why I'm like not necessarily laying blame anywhere, is the other thing that I've struggled with, and Kai, I think you'd probably agree with it in education. Miles, I think you'd agree with it on a host of things in culture, and it's sort of what you were saying about the don't like them, is that on the other side, there's an intense arrogance too. I can think about the number of people I meet in education who are convinced that their thing is the thing. They're like, no, if you don't focus on this, if you don't do class size, if you don't do da-da-da, then you don't really care about Black kids. And you're like, okay, well, that might... You're like, I don't really know if that is the... You're like, I don't... So I get why some of the storytellers are like not interested in working with them, because it does become so wild sometimes. It's in the room. And that... I think about the academic community sometimes is so intense about a narrative and has not actually seen the thing in real life. Like, I think about the number of people talking about the police or education who have never done a real thing. They've read about it. They have studied it. And then they come in the room, not necessarily with a lot of humility, but with a whole lot of intensity. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that creates this really weird thing. I can't tell you the number, you know, Kaya led Human Capital. I led Human Capital. And I remember Baltimore, people would be like, DeRay, they would give me speeches about hiring Black teachers. And I'm like, how many teachers have you hired? Like, it's not like I'm like trying not to hire Black teachers. Mm-hmm. But they would be like, you know, you don't care. And I'm like, do you, like, the mechanics of it is what I'm trying to figure out.
Come spend a day with me and let's walk through what this really looks like. But people are, you know, armchair quarterbacks. People are, you know, internet experts. And everybody wants to tell you how to do your job. And so, is right.
And I totally agree with what, we are 2 for 2, DeRay. I'm agreeing with DeRay on this podcast. You know, me and my big brother, we don't always, sometimes we...
Everybody, like, let's note this moment.
Right. So, but I do definitely agree. But I do think specifically if we're talking about documentaries, whoever it says directed by, edited by, that's the person who's in control. So no matter what you do, if you got me in a room, and even if I talk all my... righteous, feminist, annoying, queer stuff for 8 hours, and you only use 8 minutes. Right, you know what I mean? Right. Yeah. So I do think it's just a push for whoever is editing and directing this to push themselves and maybe retain something that they're not comfortable with. But those different colors make a really complex, beautiful story. Even if you have somebody who's maybe even on the more conservative side, you have Uncle Loop and you have a feminist voice. That's a colorful story. So, but I totally hear you on that. And even as I've gotten older at this ripe age of 23, I even have had to check myself when it comes to how I come into spaces, because that's part of getting older.
The one thing that I wanted to get you guys' take on is the closing part of the documentary sort of went out of the way to say Black people need Freaknik. I think the real intent is Black people need spaces of Black joy. And that I fully agree with, places where we can be. We don't need spaces. Wait, we don't need spaces where we can be our authentic self. I'm not saying it's Freaknik. But I think that it don't matter what I think. Miles, say it. Go ahead and say it.
I'm sorry. I'm Tikaya. I'm just over here. Y'all can't see me right now, but I was just over here laughing because, see, okay, so here's a fine example of diverse voices. So you don't got to agree with me. I don't know. I think that Black people have found enough spaces of Black joy. I think that we have created a lot of spaces of Black joy. I think that when there ain't no Black joy, we will find a place to party and find a place to, we have figured it out. We have figured it out with no budget. We have figured out with millions of dollars. We have done it for the Afropunk alternatives. We have done it for the churchgoers, the Hallelujah night. We have figured out whoever kind of Black you are, you're going to find a place to go party and go eat and go drink and maybe say something shameful. And you probably should have left a little bit an hour earlier. I think that we have exhausted that.
I think that's not what I thought you were going to say.
Me neither.
So I'm not saying we don't need. I'm not saying that we don't need any more or don't do those things. But I think I think sometimes when people try to use like intellectual perspectives in order to say this is why something was needed or right or whatever. I'm like, I don't know. I really think that we need a place for Black grief. I think we need a place for Black ugliness. I think we need a place for Black rage. I think that Black people tend to be able to do the sun people stuff, the sun stuff really well. I don't think we do the lunar stuff very well. I think we run away from the lunar stuff. So I push back on that. And I'm just one color of one hue of Black. Just one brush stroke on the complex portrait of Blackness.
Don't eat me up. This is why I had to ask the question, because unless there's some Rock'em Sock'em action, it's not really interesting. And this is Rock'em Sock'em. I agree with the fact that we are good at finding spaces of Black joy. I agree that we need more spaces for our grief, our rage, and the darker side of our feelings and emotions to manifest themselves, to express. But I'm always going to be for more joy than less, honey. So I want us to keep on finding spaces of Black joy. I want us to,
Keep on keeping on, but I don't want to create.
New Freaknik. You don't want a new Freaknik.
And I didn't like the creating this fake deficit of places for Black people to have joy. Like, I feel like
that's fair.
They create this fake deficit, because I even went with my Auntie Kaya with the school teachers in Philadelphia, and they were having school Nick. Not really. But when I tell you, the people were partying and drinking and carrying on, and I'm like, I said, I thought y'all were the teacher. And I'm like, y'all having fun.
Educators need spaces of Black joy, maybe and more than other people.
And they deserve it, and they have it. So
we got down in Philly. Shout out to BMAC. Woo woo.
Yes. So if the educators got it, the doctors got it, everybody, I haven't been anywhere where Black people have not been having it. So let's figure out something new. Sad Nick.
I do not sadly. Grief Nick. I do think that it is interesting though, because oftentimes the way people levy that claim, Kaya, is it's sort of a joy not without safety, but it's like without any condition. Like, it's a joy that sometimes can't, you know, joyful for who becomes the question, because you create these spaces and it's like, you know, like how the Freaknik documentary sort of glosses over the conversation about abuse and assault. You're like, I don't really know if that is what people need. And I think about a lot of places that have been sold as, like, I think about like all the church things, like a vacation Bible school. Like, I think about a lot of things that we were told was like, this was where the kids go so you can get a break. And you're like, well, that vacation Bible school sort of was terrorized a whole set of people I know. Do you know what I mean? Like, so you got a break from raising them, but they sure did not get a break for the rest of their lives being told that they were going to hell and da da da. So as we talk about the conversation about joy, I do want us to make sure that we, like, don't forget. And I think about, like, you know, what's going on with women. I know this is like a weird connect, or it's not weird because it's about Freaknik, but did you see that story about the twin girls who got heckled coming out of the store by a guy?
Oh, and they then were, they, like, killed one. He killed one.
Yeah, he like stabbed one and killed the other. Yep. He's 20 years old. They were like teenagers. And they just, you know, like, and I think they even gave him the number, but like weren't interested. And they were just walking out, twin daughters. One's, I think, still in the hospital. One died. And you're like, they were just walking outside. You know what I mean? So, like, if we don't have this serious conversation about misogyny and a misogyny noir and, you know, a whole host of other things, like, we got to figure that out before we start just like willy nilly popping up new spaces and calling that good, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay.
I did want to shout out initials AK. Thank you for emailing us about the conversation that we had on suicide in the past week. And what the writer did that was so beautiful and powerful was helped remind us that the research does say that, and this is what we talked about on the pod, that when people sensationalize the death of celebrities who die by suicide, that there does seem to be a negative reaction to that, or response that comes from not simply sharing the information, but the sensationalizing of it. And I'll read what they wrote. It is not the mere discussion of suicide that is the issue here. It is the way it is discussed that is the problem. And the news cycle isn't generally very sensitive in how they discuss famous people's suicide. There's research that shows that when suicide is discussed more matter-of-factly, it can reduce the risk of suicide. And then they went on to say that they appreciated our matter-of-fact way of talking about it. And this was good learning. There were some links in the email, and I both am proud that we had that conversation because that was a hard conversation to do, an important conversation. And thank you for AK for writing us.
I would like to say thank you as well. And like DeRay knows, especially in Auntie Kaya knows, now that I've been her nephew niece for a few years now. I try to be very vocal about my mental health because it's important. And I don't know, it's just very validating because it's, you know, it's always scary to bring those things up. And it was very validating that I was doing it in the way that felt right for me, in the way that felt responsible, and it was just very validating to hear, like, that's how you talk about it, because as somebody who deals with mental health problems, I know what I need to hear, and sometimes people who are, you know, let's say neurotypical can kind of push back, and I don't know, it felt very validating, so thank you so much for writing that.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to By the Other People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of By the Other People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. By the Other People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.